It was the stunt with the paycheck that unhinged Lenny completely. "Hello, Ms. Sandoval," came the chatty, genial voice on the other end of the line. "This is Carl Halliday with the Internal Revenue Service. I understand you're in charge of payroll of EPA." "Who did you say you were?" "Well, ma'am, we're doing an investigation into an employee of yours, a Mr. Leonard DeSico. Seems he owes Uncle Sam some money, so we need your cooperation."
"Yes?"
"We need to ask you to withhold Mr. DeSico's paycheck until we clear this matter up." Livia Sandoval, VPA's bookkeeper, shook her head. There was something about the call that made her uneasy. She asked him to hold and went to Ralph Hurley's office. "The IRS is on the line and they're asking about Lenny," she told him. "They want us to hold his paycheck." Hurley, VPA's vice president, took the call. At first, the IRS agent seemed credible enough, but it didn't take long for Hurley to become skeptical. When he asked the agent to fax him a letter with the request to hold the paycheck, the agent said his fax machine was broken. Then, when Hurley asked for a number to call him back, the caller gave him Sacramento's area code, but a number with a prefix Hurley recognized as one for California state agencies, not federal agencies. Moreover, there was something very familiar about the voice. Of course, he sounded exactly like Kevin Mitnick, that overweight, Eddie Haskellish friend of Lenny's. Kevin was a frequent caller. He chatted up the secretaries in the same friendly tone. "How was Palm Springs?" he would inquire of one. "Sorry to hear about your appendicitis," were the kind of words for another. He called so often, in fact, that it had become something of a joke among the women who answered the phone at VPA. Whenever Lenny was on the phone to Kevin Mitnick, he sounded as if he were fighting with a girlfriend. When Hurley tried calling the number back, he got a recording that said there was no such number. So just after lunch, Hurley called Lenny into his office. "Lenny, are you in trouble with the IRS?" he asked. Lenny shrugged it off. "Of course not." "Then, are you in trouble with Kevin?" That was all it took. Before he even knew what he was doing, Lenny found himself telling Hurley about Kevin. In a rather disjointed confession, he told Hurley that Kevin had been operating from VPA for the past year, that he had been letting Kevin into the building after hours to sit in front of the VPA computer until early morning. He told him that he and Kevin had been secretly using a computer 20 miles away on the USC campus as their personal data storage locker. And he told him about all the break-ins at Digital. Hurley, who had suspected nothing, was stunned to hear this. Lenny knew he was well regarded at VPA. He was the general troubleshooter who maintained the company's modest computer system. The last thing he wanted to do was lose yet another job because of Kevin. Lenny told Hurley he wouldn't have been doing all this illicit computing if it hadn't been for Kevin. In fact, he claimed, Kevin had forced him to do it. Kevin Mitnick was cannibalizing his life, so he kept letting Kevin in to use the VPA computers night after night. If he decided he didn't want to work with Kevin one night, Kevin always managed to track him down. He was a master at that. And Lenny wasn't the only one to have been terrorized by Kevin Mitnick through the years, Lenny said. He had seen Kevin cut off a person's phone service on a whim. Hurley leaned back. Well, Lenny, what are we going to do? I'll tell you right now that I want to get the authorities in here. Either you can do it or I will.
Well, geez, Lenny said, looking alarmed. I'll just get in trouble.
Hurley tried to be understanding. He told Lenny that, if he was the victim he claimed to be, he would be likely to get sympathetic treatment from the authorities. "Why don't you think it over?" he said. At 6 that evening, Lenny came back into Hurley's office.
"Well, Kevin's really done it this time."
"What do you mean?"
"He just forwarded all our lines to my house and busied out the whole switchboard."
When Hurley picked up his phone and tried to call another line in the office, he just got a busy signal. With this came another round of confessions. Now Lenny told Hurley that Kevin wasn't just a computer expert, he was adept with telephones as well. He told him about rerouting the wires in the telephone closet, and about the MCI access codes they used to call places as far away as England. The phone forwarding stunt he had just pulled was something Kevin had been threatening Lenny with for some time, Lenny said. "Something has to be done about this by tomorrow," Hurley said. "I want to see you in here at 8:30 tomorrow morning." Later that evening, both telephone lines at the Hurley residence went dead.
The next morning, Lenny told Hurley he knew just who to call at Digital, and he placed a call to the headquarters in Maynard, Massachusetts, from Hurley's office. He told the man who answered in Digital's corporate security office that he needed to talk with someone about the computer hacker who had been plaguing Digital for the past year. To make his words sink in, he started listing things: the VMS source code, the X-Safe program. Lenny said he would like to be put in touch with the FBI. He was told to sit tight for a few minutes. 5 minutes later, Chuck Bushy called him back. Lenny knew exactly who that was because he and Kevin had been monitoring Bushy's personal electronic mailbox for months. He knew Bushy was angry and fed up, and he knew that the security department at Digital would give anything at this point to catch those who had privately embarrassed the company so thoroughly.
Hello, said Lenny. I just wanted to let you know that I know who's been breaking into Digital computers for the last year.
There was silence on the other end.
Who is this?
Lenny stumbled.
My name is Leonard DeSico, and I'm calling from Los Angeles, and I want to tell you about Kevin Mitnick. I know that he's been breaking into Digital's computers all this time. I know you're looking for him.
Bushy told him to go find a secure phone and call him from there. Lenny and Hurley went together to a payphone at a nearby supermarket, and Lenny called Bushy back using Hurley's credit card.
Well, I'm a friend of his, and I'm calling you because I want to turn him in, Lenny said,
and he launched into a condensed version of what he had told Hurley the previous day. He made certain to mention all of the key incidents. He told Bushy that Kevin had taken a copy of a highly secret security program that only a handful of people within Digital were even aware of. To prove it, he named the program. He also said that a copy of the latest version of Digital's operating system for the VAX had been taken as well. There was silence on the other end. Lenny kept talking. He said he wanted to be as much help as possible in apprehending Kevin Mitnick, who was, Lenny intoned, a menace to society. Silence. Digital had better move fast, Lenny added, because Kevin had been talking lately about giving up his break-ins, and the company might not have many more opportunities to catch him in the act. Bushy was speechless at the sudden lucky break. This breathless young man on the telephone was describing the break-ins that had been plaguing the company for months. That night, Bushy and Kent Anderson, the company's head of European security, were on a plane to Los Angeles. While the two Digital people were on their way, an FBI special agent named Chris Hedrick summoned Lenny to a meeting at a hotel in the San Fernando Valley. Lenny was impressed by the very ordinariness of the agent. Slight and bespectacled, the low-key Hedrick looked as if he would be more at home in a classroom in front of a chalkboard, scribbling out differential equations. In fact, some of Lenny's high school teachers were flashier than this. When the Digital security men arrived at the hotel, they turned one guest room into a makeshift command center. Lenny drove out to all-purpose storage, retrieved the 3 dozen tapes filled with the fruits of his and Kevin's electronic adventures, and surrendered them to his interrogators. Lenny stayed at the hotel, talking until 4 a.m., feeling rather like a hero. He was brazen enough to mention to Bushy that Digital could have solved this frustrating case much sooner. If Bushy had pressed people at USC, university records would have revealed a history of problems with Kevin Mitnick. Also, Lenny told him, if Bushy had consulted Digital's old records, he surely would have seen that Mitnick had gotten into trouble as early as 1980 for breaking into a Digital computer. Then there was the Pacific Bell security memo that followed the Santa Cruz operation incident and circulated around Digital several months later, at the same time that Mitnick's activity inside Digital was at its peak. The names had been deleted from the memo, but a few phone calls to Pacific Bell Security would have made the Mitnick connection. The next morning, together with Lenny and Ralph Hurley, the authorities drew up a simple plan to verify Lenny's claims. As usual, Kevin was planning to show up at VPA at 7 that evening, after the regular employees had all gone home. Hedrick's plan was to use a computer room on the first floor of the building to monitor everything Mitnick did from the main computer room, which was one flight up on the opposite side of the building. Hurley stayed around that night, too. His presence downstairs would prevent Kevin from using the first-floor computer room. An FBI agent named Gerald Harmon arrived at 5 p.m. and began to set up a surveillance. He wired Lenny with a tape recorder, fastening an elastic belt with 2 pockets, one for the tape recorder and one for the microphone, to his chest. A digital engineer installed a monitoring device into the VPA computer that would let them watch and record everything that happened from the system upstairs. When he arrived that evening, Kevin seemed to be in good cheer. In fact, he was on a roll. He had recently gotten a more extensive list of users on the computer at the university in Leeds, England, and wanted to try to get their passwords. He was also hoping to break into the machine of Neil Clift, the Leeds researcher whose hobby was spotting security holes in VMS. The agents planted themselves downstairs, and Hurley stayed in his office. Lenny greeted Kevin outside and lowered his voice.
"Kev, we can't use both computer rooms tonight. Hurley's working late."
The two went straight upstairs, and Kevin began to dial directly into digital. His first order of business was the digital engineering cluster. Lenny was wearing a loose-fitting T-shirt, but he was still worried that Kevin would pat him on the back, thwacking his hand against the recording equipment. Kevin sensed that Lenny was jittery.
"What's going on with you tonight?" he asked. "You're acting strange."
Downstairs, in the hastily appointed command center, the digital people must have been surprised to learn that all their theories had been wrong. Not only was this not the work of an international spy ring, but the notorious West German Chaos Group didn't seem to be involved at all. Instead, the culprit appeared to be an obese, nearsighted, 25-year-old high school dropout from L.A., whose diet, according to his friend, consisted of greasy cheeseburgers and big gulp colas from the nearby 7-Eleven. To say nothing of Lenny, a whiner who had spent months letting himself be bedeviled and blackmailed by the fat one. This must have been a far less glamorous denouement than any of them had imagined. Inside a stuffy room the size of a walk-in closet, listening to two grown men taunt one another like children. As the evening wore on, it became clear that this Kevin Mitnick was indeed their man. Mitnick seemed to have a special fascination with the Leeds computer that night. He talked someone at Leeds into giving him a password, then logged on to the British system and perused lists containing the names and access codes of everyone with legitimate access to the Leeds computer. The FBI agent seemed befuddled by what he was witnessing. Anderson explained to him that once Mitnick had obtained the list of authorized users and their passwords, he could come back later and log on as any of those people. This young man's facility with the telephone network in general, and MCI codes in particular, was impressive enough. As soon as he finished his session on the Leeds computer, Mitnick dialed his way into an MCI mail account, from which he was able to harvest MCI credit card numbers so that the session would never show up on VPA's phone bill. He seemed to know exactly what commands to type, as if he had done it hundreds of times before. But even more remarkable was Kevin's ability to monitor Pacific Bell's telephone traces, and that was precisely what had kept Digital at bay for so long. His knowledge of the phone system was so extensive that he could tap straight into Pacific Bell's monitoring equipment and keep a careful watch over anyone trying to trace his call. For that purpose, he always had two active terminals in front of him, one for his breaking and entering, and a second to show what was happening on Pacific Bell's computer. If a trace to his phone line started, he could log off at once. Anderson had been in the computer business for nearly a decade, and he was aware that hackers were known for their patience and stamina. This one seemed to be among the most indefatigable. At 1 a.m, long after the FBI agent and the jet-lagged engineers had grown bleary-eyed, Mitnick seemed to be just waking up. If it was true that he was recently married, didn't his wife wonder where he was? Lenny's role seemed to be a small one, though the surveillance team suspected he might be lowing low for its benefit. Lenny's principal job that night was to keep an eye on the second computer terminal that the pair used to maintain their electronic lookout for any traces. Lenny had done his part. He had led them straight to the person who had eluded them all these months. Kevin was doing so many illegal things that Lenny was surprised the agents didn't storm upstairs and arrest him on the spot. So he stole downstairs and rapped lightly on the door of the small computer room. The door opened a crack, and Harmon stuck his head out.
"Well," Lenny asked, "aren't you going to arrest him now?"
Harmon shot back a stern look. "Not just yet." Harmon said they had seen quite enough for one evening, and they were going to pack up for the night. He ushered Lenny inside and removed the taping equipment. Lenny grew impatient.
"What do you want, a signed confession?"
"That would be nice." Harmon smiled and gently pressed him out the door. Lenny climbed the stairs again, shaking his head.
"What's going on? Where have you been?"
asked Kevin, speaking, it appeared, straight to the computer screen. He was back in Leeds.
I was just checking to see if Hurley's still here.
Listen, Kev, I'm tired, and I have to get up in the morning. Can't we call it a night?
No, I'm onto something great here.
Kev, come on, let's go. Lenny was becoming exasperated. Kevin turned and glared at him. It wasn't until 3 a.m. that Kevin was finally ready to call it quits. When the two went outside, they saw that Kevin's car had a flat tire, so Lenny offered to drive him home. After a pit stop at the Fatburger, in a fit of generosity, Lenny told Kevin he would pay for Kevin's meal. Surprised but not about to object, Kevin ordered two King Fatburgers with everything on them, large fries and a large Diet Coke. Lenny ordered fries and watched as Kevin, out of habit, systematically emptied half a dozen ketchup packets onto his paper placemat, then jabbed the mound of sauce with his French fries. His meal dispensed with, Kevin asked Lenny what time he should arrive at VPA the following night. Lenny said he was busy. As usual, an argument ensued, but rather than retread old ground, Lenny told Kevin to find his own way home and stalked out the door.